This is Dr. Richard Verona conducting an oral history interview with Joey Welsh. We're continuing today on October 27th, 2005. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Joey's again in Kesterville, Texas. Joey, let's pick up approximately where we left off last time. We were discussing some of the missions and some of the different things you did while out on your patrols and your missions. I wanted to ask you if you could make some comments about the effectiveness and the way you all operated in such small groups. Most people didn't do what you did. Most people work in larger platoon size, I mean, maybe squads sometimes, really platoon size, company size operations, you know, those who are in the Army and the Marine Corps on the ground. What can you say about operating such a small unit and how it worked for you?
First of all, every major unit in the infantry as a recon element, let's say, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And when the first one, when 173rd went over there, they had what they called the long-range reconnaissance patrol.
Mm-hmm.
It was a detachment because they were brigade level.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, 101st came over and they had the 101st long-range reconnaissance patrol.
Mm-hmm.
And these were guys that were hand-picked, usually attached to the headquarters element. And through the S2, we learned that, from lessons learned, that we're not sending in 150 men.
Mm-hmm.
Is not going to find the enemy, unless the enemy wants to find you.
Right.
Because they'll sit on the hilltop and they'll hear an M15 chopper coming.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a need, you know, for small units that are trained basically to shoot, move, and communicate behind enemy lines.
Yes.
You know, basically our unit was organized with really highly trained and motivated soldiers. In fact, most of them had at least 6 months in combat.
How important was it for them to have that experience to do with you all?
Well, very important, because we were going, at the time, there was only brigade level alert. In other words, they went out only so far for their brigade. They worked for their unit. We were going to be a corps asset.
Mm-hmm.
So we were taking a whole corps over, which was three corps.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is beginning at the bottom, Delta's 1, then 2, then 3, and, you know, DMZ area 4.
Mm-hmm.
So we had from the west, which was Ho Chi Minh Trail entry, all the way across to the east.
Mm-hmm.
That's where they cut it down.
Mm-hmm.
So, but most of the guys had at least 6 months in combat, and they had to undergo an intensive selection program before they were assigned. It was an all-volunteer, okay? So, in my case, I volunteered for Airborne, I volunteered Vietnam, I volunteered for alert, you know, so I was a three-time volunteer, and most of them were. Really, only the best could prevail, because once you went through the training, you would be assigned to a team, and they would take you out once, twice, and if you didn't cut it, you were gone. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
You could be peered out. If you were good and they felt you was worthy of it and everything like that, they felt that you was going to work out, then they would try to get you down to the MAC-T Reconder School,
mm-hmm.
which in my 25 years was probably the best school ever.
Right.
I mean, you know, it was just run by the old B-52 guys from SF. And it was the only school in the world where an ordinary graduate, you actually had to go on a live combat mission, you know?
Yeah.
So,
you already described the time in the school.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's good. Well, once you get out and once you get into where you start operating the small units, how long did it take for you to prove yourself?
Our unit was formed from 1967.
Mm-hmm.
And what we did was we took half of the unit from the old timers from 101st. We really kind of raped you know, the best, one of the best lurp companies around, and then we got the new guys, all right? So our unit was organized to provide long-range reconnaissance, surveillance, target acquisition, and special type missions on a core level basis, and usually operated in 4 to 16 man teams. Now, we also had the capacity to operate as a platoon-sized force and conduct, like, regular recon in force missions. Or we could do, search and rescue or snatch missions, which is trying to get, you know, a POW or POW rescue, you know.
Yeah.
And a lot of times we were attached to special forces units, quite a bit. And since we were in play crew and B Company was there, we trained with them a lot, and plus we went to the Congress. when they formed it, we had the largest unit, 241 men. Okay? And that's just on the platoon side, that's 4 platoons with 7 6-man teams. Plus you had your communication platoon and your headquarters platoon. Now, due to the Army's manpower mismanagement, they had to start thinking that 6 months from September, half of them guys are ready to leave because they've been in combat for 6 months before, you know, to make up the company. But, so we slowly started, you know, losing guys. Guys are still carrying. You lose guys for one reason or another. KIA, got wounded in action. Any numerous amount of reasons. We were running like maybe 4 or 5 man teams. You know? Now, if you get with a team and you develop yourself, when you first get there, regardless of your experience, you will be assigned to a team. Well, you will go through 2 weeks indoctrination. Then you're assigned to a team. And then the team takes you out and they critique you. They help you. They don't try to, you know, get rid of you. They try to help and see how you're doing.
How long does it take for them to kind of accept you?
Well, it depends. I had already been over there for a year and been running patrol.
So that gave you instant credibility?
So that gave me, no, not at all. What it did was, I was a lot easier, it was easier for me to adapt than from a guy who might come from you know, a grunt unit or just from the States, because it was getting so bad that we needed to be pulling guys from the States, and that's why they had to go through the selection program, because, you know, we were just, in the summer of 68, we were running really low. Okay? So I went on 2 missions and went straight to Recondo School. And 4 of us went to Recondo School. One, as a matter of fact, the first week, one was put out academically the second week. I graduated in the third week, and one was recycled for 1 week. So it was really an intense, very, very professional, but very, very intense school. And the only people that did go through it were U.S. LURPs and Rangers, Korean LURPs and Rangers, Thai, and Australia. The Arvin could not and would not support. We were called upon to train them, and we sent a platoon up, and after 2 classes, the commanders, the Arvin commanders, were a little bit, they were pissed off because only 30% of the people were graduating. Okay?
And that's not enough for them.
And no, they, you know, the attrition rate wasn't too good.
Right.
And basically, so the platoon leader called back and said, hey, you know, they want them all to graduate. And he said, hey, pack it up and come home. I mean, we weren't going to do that. So, Now, they weren't Arvin Rangers. Arvin Rangers is an entirely different operation. They're trained by SS. Mm-hmm. And, but the Arvin, you know, they just weren't. I guess everybody had been doing their fighting for them so long that they just didn't have it in them, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. But, so we were operated in 4 to 6 men teams at a core level, meaning any unit working within that core, whether it's core headquarters, South Korean Army, Arvin Army, anybody that has intelligence about a certain area,
mm-hmm.
it's a lot better to send in 4 or 5 men and sneak around for 4 or 5 days to try and confirm, you know, if this intelligence is good,
mm-hmm.
rather than put in 150 men, jeopardize maybe them getting, you know, whacked, or if Charlie don't want to be found, he will not be found by 150 guys.
That you guys could find him.
Right. Because we knew, lived, eat, and breathe like them. You know, I mean, once you get into that type of a unit, you bond as a team, there's no talking anyway, but the thought process is always the same. We know what to do if, you know,
mm-hmm.
we always know what to do if. And as impatient as Americans are,
mm-hmm.
I never thought that I could do it, but I mean, well, when you're going through Master Recondo School, they'll say, okay, we're going to stop here. You make one adjustment. You might sit there 2.5 hours. If you move, you leave the course. Okay? So the idea was that you had to have patience to just move slow and never talk. Everything was done in hand signals. And once you got that team that worked together all the time, okay, they were very, very lethal. Because they just, I don't know, the expression was, I could smell a goose at 500 meters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we went into what, like an isolation period prior. No shaving, no, you know, no shower, no nothing, scrubby, dirty stuff. We want to smell like the jungle when we go in.
Mm-hmm.
And any eating we did, we had the little packets. We'd mix them up, eat a little bit, and wrap them up, put them in our pocket, and move, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I won't say people didn't smoke, but when they did, they basically knew what they were doing and how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like I said, in our instance, we were so far out that we needed a combo platoon that would be set out in between the base camp we were working out of and the area we were in on top of the biggest mountain they could find, just so we could get communication relayed back through them. They were called X-ray teams.
Mm-hmm.
Could be maybe 8 or 10 of them.
Mm-hmm.
Without them, you could not communicate. Nowadays, you know, with the satellite, little 10-pound radio, you can communicate. You know, I used to communicate from Thailand to, you know, Okinawa. You know, it was nothing. The satellite, but in them days we had a Prick 25, you know,
mm-hmm.
and so it was.
Joey, describe that radio. What was the size and weight?
It was around 25 pounds. Okay, it was, I guess, what we did is how we lined up. Everybody did different, and you can rotate. There's no set rule. It's what works. The situation dictates. We don't go by no, you know, the FM says this, you know. Now, of course, when you're in the beginning of your training, you've got to start somewhere. But once you learn from your experiences, you're not going to be, you know, following the book.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we did what we felt would work. For instance, we would have Point Man. Point Man was usually very, very stealth-like. He wasn't rattled easily,
mm-hmm.
and he just had that sixth sense. Okay.
Do you actually train somebody for that, or do you just find out, okay, this person's ready now?
Yeah. And, well, like me, I finally became the point man of my team. I wanted that. I had done it before, but I just felt, you know, but at times, sometimes you've got to pull them off because they get burnt,
mm-hmm.
you know. And the slack man, he takes up his slack, but he worries more about what direction we should be moving.
Mm-hmm.
So the point man doesn't have to worry about messing with compass or nothing. He's got a general idea and real good map reading skills. He has an idea of what terrain features to look for, but the slack man keeps him sort of in line.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and takes up his slack.
Mm-hmm.
Behind him would normally be the team leader. Behind the team leader would be a scout with the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And then behind him would be a scout or two scouts, depending upon what we had. Some team leaders preferred to carry the radio on their own. This way they don't have to look for anybody. You know, they've got it right there. And, you know, they can do all the talking on their own.
Mm-hmm.
It would just depend, like I said, on the team. It's not really that much heavier or anything like that. It's more, because everybody splits up the load.
Right.
In other words, everybody will carry an extra battery. If we take out any extra equipment or something bigger, a 60 or something, everybody carries some ammo. So we kind of share the load.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So if we were given a specific reason or target, then what happens is the team leader and assistant team leader get the briefing. They go brief the team and tell them the five, who, what, when, where, why, and how. Okay? Now go to work, and what these guys do, a good team, is they're told exactly what to get. They get all the equipment ready, they prepare everything, they get everything ready, and the day before, the team leader will go up with usually the chopper pilot and the platoon. The team leader and the platoon leader will go up with the platoon leader usually oversees the infiltration and all from the air, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And what we'll do is we'll explain to the chopper pilot, all right, here's our AO, and we'd like to fly this route, and we're looking at maybe here or there, and we need to pick out a primary landing zone and an alternate.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of contradicting to a LERP. If I go into my primary and they shoot the hell out of it, I think we've accomplished our mission, Now you go chase them.
Right.
No, wrong answer. As long as nobody's wounded, you're going to go into an alternate and find out who shot them. You know? So
when you say go into an alternate, what do you mean?
An alternate landing zone. In other words,
you're gonna take it somewhere else. And
yeah.
Find out what's going on?
Yeah. So in other words, out of maybe a 6-click area, you'll fly that thing. And what you're doing as a team leader is you're looking at terrain. Okay, how it's set up. Can you see any blue lines? Can you see any trails? Are there any good LVs, not too big, but, where you can get in, and then you have to find another one, and not really that close, So, in other words, you're doing aerial observation recon, and in that, you tell the tribal pilot, okay, this is going to be my primary. I want to go in on my second dip. That would mean he would jump, be flying your area, and he, just like any other chopper, he would drop down and make like a false insertion. He would drop down, but he wouldn't leave you off. The second time he dropped down, he would be at your primary drop zone, and he'd drop you off. Then he continued to do, and then the third time he'd drop down and do another fake one, and then just do it like a fly around, like he was patrolling. And we would get off and hit the wood line. As soon as we're in the wood line, we freeze for about 15 minutes. We don't move. And that's to get your senses right. Then we do a combo check with the CC, command and control ship, which is out of sight. And once we got the combo check, that was it, then we would be on our way. And we would move in a pre-designated route that we had decided on prior to. And we would send in 4 sit reps a day. And they were only like 6 liners, and they were all coded. So.
Can you explain that? What do you mean?
Okay. You have an SOI, which was, now they call them communications, electronics, operations, order, but it's a little book. That's wrapped around your throat and tie key and everything like that. Has all your call signs for everything. Everything from the chopper on up to a B-52. And when you call in your situation report, it'll have maybe, like I said, 5 lines, something like that. Where you're at, your location, your time, any activity, and a couple other things, just so they pinpoint you on the map. Okay, all right. Then, of course, have your proposed movement, and they try to see if you're staying on your movement. At any time, the team leader feels that we need to move because the maps are old. And going, 70, 80 knots in the chopper, you don't see what you see when you get on the ground. So we might be in there and say, well, look, there's a blue line down there, or there's cheese, and we just ran into a huge trail. And it's being used, which we couldn't see from the air due to the canopy. And it's a good place to set up an ambush. So we would stop, send in the sit rep that we are sitting along this area, and waiting for see if anybody comes along.
How long would you have to wait? It varies.
Well, it would depend on when you hit it. If you hit it in the middle of the day, you sit there, you know, several hours. Because Charlie, a lot of times, if when you're good and Charlie doesn't has no idea that you're there, you're in his backyard, you know, he'll come, you know, tumbling on down the, you know, trail at any time.
Right.
Okay.
And not knowing you're there.
Right. Not knowing we're there. And talk, and then all you can hear him coming. And then again, he might come, and there might be 100 of them, 200 of them. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't ambush, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just...
You just hold tight.
Huh?
You just hang tight right there.
You just hang tight, and you don't do nothing. And, you know, I've had guys, you know, stop and take a piss and almost be pissing on you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just let them go, and hopefully nobody sees you, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then you wait till they move on, and then... you'll call in your report, and then usually what we'll do is get the fast movers out,
mm-hmm.
you know, and get prepared for an extraction and or reactionary force to come, and then, you know, knowing the route that they're going, and then what we do is to start calling in the stuff, everything from artillery to, you know, jet fighters, you know, I call them jet fighters, we call them fast movers, you
right.
know,
okay.
And, you know, just try to, you know, tear them up.
Mm-hmm.
Then again, the order might be given is pursue. In other words, well, where the hell are they going?
Right.
Because you might, they might lead you to a base camp.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
What was the optimal thing you wanted them to do? Lead you to a base camp like that?
Well, it depends because they're not that dumb. Okay.
They're assuming they're being watched?
Well, here's what, in the first year we made a mistake, they made a lot of mistakes. Is the first time, is what would happen is, well, three or four guys would come tripping along. Oh man, they're perfect. And they'd slam them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they didn't know that 200 meters behind them was a company.
Mm-hmm.
So they would send somebody purposely up there, you know, and, like, if we send somebody up there, we go up there and, you know, go slow, but if they're in their backyard, they'll send three or four people to walk the band.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Okay.
Now, you've got to make that decision when they get in that kill zone, whether you feel that, you know, we should go for this, or depending, I would go with, if they're dressed real good, and they're NBA and all, then they've got plenty of friends around.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we can knock these guys down. They might be 2 miles from their base camp. They might be 200 meters.
Mm-hmm.
There might be some 200 guys following them. There might be nobody following them. So, you would have to call it on the spot.
Okay.
And once you commit yourself, then all hell breaks loose. And then, you know, but usually you'd have that gut feeling. And they had also had trail watchers, which would be guys that would set up on a trail or on the side of a trail,
mm-hmm.
in hopes to finding Americans who had a bad tendency to follow trails.
Mm-hmm.
You know, come walking along the trail or alongside of it or across it or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Very rarely did we ever hit a trail unless we were in such thick stuff and we had to get down and across it or something like that, but it would be one at a time, you know, tactically as we could. You try to stay off the trail, you know?
Yeah.
But there has been times when you look up and at the same time he's looking down and boom, simultaneously you're both popping caps. And you know right then and there that his friends are on the way, you know. So you do the most damage you can, and you never return the way you came.
No, I know. I think I understand why. That explain exactly why you would not want to do that.
Okay, you never return the way you came because Charlie would purposely let, especially Lurk, more so than the drunk, would purposely let you go by if you was not going near anything, because they knew that if they struck us, unless they annihilated us quick, we could wreak havoc on them. If they were an infantry company, they'd leave them go by because they had an ambush set up farther down the area, and then when the guys would retreat, they would be waiting for them.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever you go in some way, you want to come out an opposite way so the enemy's not already got you plotted.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically it.
Tell me about, again, how the North Vietnamese, or I guess the VC, but really this is the North Vietnamese Army we're talking about, right? Who are going to be spotting you guys in North Vietnam?
Well,
or not?
No, I wasn't in North Vietnam.
Okay, so you're...
We weren't allowed there.
Well, yes, but we know that Lurf Company is operated in North Vietnam, so...
Well, yeah, but you're talking North Vietnam being up in the Four Corps area, which is DMZ.
Well, above the DMZ.
We were on the Third Corps area, which was Central Highlands, Pleiku area,
mm-hmm.
on the west coast, which was... Play Madrang and stuff like that. That was where one of the main corridors of the Ho Chi Minh Trail came in.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if these are declassified or not, but we all know that...
They're pretty much declassified.
Yeah, that was basically... that's why you had a CCN and a CCS, Command and Control North and Command and Control South in MACV South. They would do, the South would do the cross-border operations, you know, from a certain point down west, like into Cambodia, and then the Command and Control North would do the ones up north.
Mm-hmm.
We worked more with the CCN program. And I was in Cambodia, you know, several times
mm-hmm.
before we were supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
looks the same, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's going across an imaginary line.
Pardon me?
Going across an imaginary line, the border, you know, but it all looks the same.
Yeah, you know, you just know when, you know, you definitely... Because you don't do no visual recon,
mm-hmm.
all right? So you definitely got to know, you know, where you're at. And as I said in the first, at the beginning, the problem, the mistake they made with our company being as large as it was, at the same time as they formed the three core alerts, they formed the two core LERP,
mm-hmm.
which was a little bit smaller, but they formed a helicopter squadron with them.
Mm-hmm.
So they had four or five slicks and two or three gunships that were there at their disposal. They were assigned with that company,
mm-hmm.
which was so much... so much more effective, because if you live and eat and breathe with them pilots, they're a bond forms with you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we, you know, like I mentioned chopper pilots earlier, I mean, if they didn't have the balls and tenacity that they had, they didn't know us from nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But, that was written up within 6 months that we need dedicated, because we might go with any unit that's in that group in that core, and they want us to do their intel.
Mm-hmm.
And they have the 155th Aviation Company supporting them.
Mm-hmm.
So now you're like, you know, down on the lower level, and you get, you know, a couple slick pilots and a few gunship pilot guys in there on the briefing, and it's just not as personal, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been times when, and they're supposed to be dedicated. That means once they drop you off, that they sit and wait, you know, in case they're needed.
Mm-hmm.
But there has been times when I've called for choppers and they didn't have any.
Okay.
Excuse me?
What do you do?
Yell. I mean, we're already getting shot at.
Right.
And Tomo, we weren't very tactful on communications. You figure if you haven't talked in 3 days, and when you hit contact, you're screaming into that thing. You know, I'm in contact. I got one man down. I'm at this location. I need gunships in the air. I need a medevac. I need extraction. Okay, I need some fast movers. You know, excuse me? What the hell do you mean there's no effing choppers? You sorry son? You know,
Yeah.
I swear on my children, the guy said, run and hide. I said, where the hell do you expect me to... I'm cleaning this up a lot.
Well, Joey, you don't need to clean it up. You need to say it.
Where
like
the fuck do you think I'm going to run and hide? If I could run and hide, I wouldn't be getting shot at, you dumbass. I'll kill you when I get the fuck back there, you pin-pushing motherfucker. Okay, that's basically the way I would talk to them.
Uh-huh.
Okay? Because they let them choppers go somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I've called for a medevac. Are the medevacs refueling? What do you mean he's refueling? How can he be refueling? Was any of our guys shot? No. I mean, that really, I would say, was our biggest downfall. If we would have had a squadron, the size of our company,
mm-hmm.
we should have had, I'd say, 6 to 8 slicks and maybe 4 to 6 gunships
mm-hmm.
assigned. Live, eat, breathe, and travel with us. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And a maintenance section for them. And we would have done 70% better than we ever done. Just for that fact. Case in point, I'm in Cambodia. I get to my point, I code in my pickup point. I get back coded wrong 4 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
He brings back 4 minutes. That is putting me, and I'm 2,000 meters in, that's putting me back across the border. I do it one more time. He comes back with the same thing. I turned off the radio and told everyone, you know, radio silence. And you got to go up and whisper in here. I don't like what's happening. I know teams that went over there and never came back.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the person that put us in here knows where to pick us up.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy can't be the same guy. So we walked out. We walked out, and once I crossed that border and we got in a secure position, which I would not give away, I called headquarters and I laid it on them that, you know, in code, we were, you know, I don't know what the fuck happened, but we were, you know, we aborted. We aborted the pickup due to the fact that the pilot would not come to our coordinates.
Mm-hmm. How often did this happen?
It only happened to me once. Mm-hmm. Cross-border operation.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was agreeable. They said, fuck yeah, we're on our own with all that some bitch. They knew what we were supposed to pick up.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we took our time, walked out, and once we got, you know, we were across the line and we were in a good location, we felt we were secure in, then we called. Then they said, where are you? We said, well, we don't know about that. Well, what do you mean? Well, I said, I'm not too sure. I want you to send the bird dog out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so they sent a bird dog up, and I knew where I was. But do you really? You don't know because they're not.
Mm-hmm.
So what I did is I gave the bird dog a coordinate, an off coordinate, just so I could see him. And then I signal mirrored him in. All right?
Uh-huh.
And what he does is when he flies over, he's lined up. He knows he's lined up. Prior to him, right before he gets there, I'll say, like, bingo, and he'll flap his wings, you know, he'll turn, and he'll put a dot, and he'll put you within 10 meters of where you really are.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? At that time, I felt that, you know, we were in a good location, we had an LZ close by, and he took a nice ride around for us.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
and said, you know, everything looks good. And then using him, he called in the thumb support and the chopper and into a small LZ. And then they picked us up. Now, when you return from a mission,
mm-hmm.
there's teams, let's say you have five teams. Let's say three are out. One is support, pushing them out, you know, helping them out, and one's on rest, and then they rotate around,
mm-hmm.
if you're lucky. Well, the support team, as soon as we land, they come up and they smother you. Hey, and they get your weapon.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And then they take you to a detox, what they call a detox.
Mm-hmm.
It's an isolated area where you can take a shower and drink beer and, you know, just blow off steam. But I had basically threatened to kill someone, and so they didn't let me go to the action. Well, they were on me like... And they send your buddy. They send your best buddy who, you know, boy, because I come off that chopper, he didn't even land. Boy, I was off the skids and running, and boy, they grab me and, you know.
Yeah, and you feel like they're going to take you to keep you safe, basically.
Yeah, they took me to detox, and there I could scream and holler and, you know, rant and rave and
mm-hmm.
all that shit. But
While your buddy or someone else is going to debrief and take care of business?
Yeah, I think I was the ATL and the TL. He was kind of freak, so I was sort of running things, and he just did what I said, and then he briefed, and I told him, I said, you tell them if they want me, I'm right here. Come and get me. Send that son of a bitch down here. I'll come up there and I'll fucking, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I was pissed. And that, basically, they risked our lives because they didn't have the balls to stand up and say, no, them planes, them birds are ours.
Mm-hmm.
And that, in our history, is written about our first commander. You know, his report to the Corps commander was, we need dedicated air support.
Right.
We cannot survive and function efficiently when you go to support a unit that's being supported by another unit for their aviation, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the chopper's pilot's fault. He's told to go do here, and who knows why, I don't know. But it's happened to me on a couple occasions. But when it happens to me over there, from being with Project Omega and stuff like that, and knowing about teams going over there and not coming back, when he told me that he didn't know, in other words, he was saying he wasn't coming, and I radioed silent. And boy, they were pissed.
Mm-hmm.
Because they called me for, well, we spent the night, so they called me all that day, and the next morning is when I finally made contact. When I felt that I was in a secure enough position to protect my man, and also I wanted the witness.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I called the bird dog.
Right.
I told him, I don't know where I'm at. Send the bird dog to this location around. And then this way, the bird dog was up there monitoring everything. And I felt that that bird dog was, if they tried to do anything stupid, the bird dog was right there. And so also,
was the bird dog aware that this was probably what was happening?
No.
Okay.
I believe that, see, since I was in country, the bird dog, they did this all the time, to take their little ride. And usually your platoon leader was in the back. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's the only place they ever were shooting. Anyway. And they would, not all of them, but mine.
Mm-hmm.
But you could do that to any bird dog if you was, you know, if you seen a bird dog and it was quiet and no one was around, I'd try to get him on the radio, but if I couldn't, I would flash him in a heartbeat, and then he'd get on ours, frequency, and I'd get him just to fly over us and give us a grid check, because he's going to put you within 10 meters. And you feel pretty damn good if you're within 200,
mm-hmm.
you know, because of them maps. But then you know exactly where you are, so you're pinpointed on the map, so whenever you move and or call anything in, you know, you've got to know where you're at.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
That's the bottom line. You've got to, and that's what probably is your lifeline, is the radio and the map. If you can't function on the ground and really know where you're at all times, and you know you're moving through shit, it's tangled up, and that's why you've got two men usually counting pace and direction. That's the slack man, and usually you'll have the point man who, without even using a map, by terrain analysis, keeps you on, you know, where you're supposed to be.
Mm-hmm. How hard is it to keep up with where you are on these kind of patrols?
Pardon me?
How hard is it for you to keep up with where you are exactly on these kind of patrols?
Well, it's not hard because we didn't move for long periods of time.
Mm-hmm.
We would move depending on the terrain. We moved slow, very slow, and purposeful.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's eyes and ears are open. We might move for 10 minutes, stop, look, listen, feel, move another 10, 15 minutes. That would just go on and on.
How far apart physically are you from each other? Are you, you know,
now that would depend on the terrain also.
Sure.
Okay? If it's wide open terrain, you got to open up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've been in some stuff that, God, I felt like I was in, you know, upstate Pennsylvania, you know, or North Carolina, you know, it's just like,
mm-hmm.
it's too open. I didn't like it, you know. And then if we hit a field, you know, or an open area that's not on the map, then we'll box it.
Mm-hmm.
Or if we hit a river or a lake,
mm-hmm.
you know, I'll come up on the lake and I'll shoot an azimuth across the lake, right?
Mm-hmm.
And get that azimuth where I'm supposed to be on, and then I'll do a right angle to the right, and then to the left, and then to the left, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll do a back azimuth, so we should be on the same point,
mm-hmm.
and continue to go. And we're not the same way with a field. We're going to go in a field, and it's not that big, we won't have to shoot it, but on a major terrain feature like a lake or something, you pick something on very distinguishable on the other side of the lake that you can shoot an azimuth off of,
mm-hmm.
and then you get a back azimuth, and then you do 90 degrees basically around it and get back on track.
Mm-hmm.
But
how long does this take to do? I guess it depends on terrain, obviously.
Yeah,
weather, but
it doesn't matter. You're not going to cross the lake. But
true.
You want to make sure that it's almost like what we used to call, you know, LRP, astral projection. You're just going to wind up across the lake right at the same location that you put that compass on. Okay, mm-hmm. so that you're staying on your azimuth.
Okay.
You know, there's 3 degrees off, you know, and in 1,000 meters, that can put you way off.
Mm-hmm.
And what you do is you use the terrain association. If you're looking at the map, you say, okay, I'm going to move about 200 meters and I should see this saddle to my left.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then I'm going to move, you know, change my azimuth or whatever. So you use terrain association. If you move 200-300 meters and you ain't seen no saddle or nothing, then you start getting a little bit suspicious. Or let's use a blue line. Okay, we're going to move and we're going to, when we get to the blue line or see the blue line, okay, then we're going to do a 90 and we're going to run along the blue line to monitor it, where we might be able to pick up a good spot. Because everybody needs water.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's been times when we've needed water, and you can call in for resupply. I never ever called in for resupply, and we were up in the thick triple canopy stuff. And we're working with, I won't mention the unit, but they were calling in resupply. So they fly over and drop in these 5-gallon plastic barrels. Pretty soon you could hear them, I want 2 packs of Winston and all this. And in the meantime, we were on these big, big, huge rocks. We were all covered with moss. And I would take like 3 canteens at a time. And I was sitting up there, and because it is triple canopy, there's a lot of little puddles if you know where to find them.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just take my little thing and take my time, and I'd fill up canteen, throw a couple tablets in it, and shake it up. And we filled everybody's canteens up while we listened to these guys getting these choppers riding over top of their position, throwing out these bundles and shit, and we're saying, man, Jesus, why don't you just, you know, shoot up flares and let everybody know where you're at?
Mm-hmm.
But that comes with experience.
Mm-hmm.
We were underneath, actually, like a huge, monstrous rock was jutting out from the side of the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
So we got in there where we know no one could see us from the top.
Mm-hmm.
We had, it was like a little fortress. And then what I did is I scouted up top and found these little puddles all over the place. And after maybe 6-8 trips, everybody was full of water.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. You know, we did it. I don't know if they, maybe, I know they were in the same terrain and same area because we were actually helping them out.
Right.
You know, but usually our mission was from a higher headquarters, say their division, saying, okay, we have information that there's an intelligence, a communication system of some sort in this general location. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Would you check it out?
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is like so far out that, you know, we have to have radio x-ray and all that kind of stuff. No friendlies are in the area and have never been as far as they know. And so they'll send us out on things like that.
Right.
And from being, from doing it, once you start getting near the place you feel that it might be, because it happened to me, first thing we hit was a punji field. Okay?
Yeah.
So nobody got, you know, but we got through it, so we knew we were on the right track. And then we came down into a saddle, and as we started down the saddle, it was a sapling, maybe 6 inches in diameter, and it was fresh cut, just a one slice, and it was falling and leaning towards this direction, or a little bit off to the right where we were going, which was the top of the next mountain on the saddle. So it was getting dark. It was coming to the time. It was like 4 or 5, whatever. We always set up before dark. Charlie sets up after dark. Charlie moves before light. We move right after light. That's the way the deal was.
Did you learn that from experience, or would he tell you this?
Yeah, that's the way it was. So you need, he knew that terrain so much better. That he could move at night easier because he knew the trail system and everything like that. And we would play hell trying to get out at night when that chopper's got to turn on that big old floodlight and stuff. So that's where we worked it. Right at twilight, we would pick the thickest stuff that might take us an hour just to crawl into. You know, the thickest terrain that we could find, and just get bunched up in a little wagon wheel. So, if it took us an hour of creeping into it, you know, the enemy, unless they tried to creep into it, would definitely have to make some noise to get to it.
Right.
Okay. And by that time, it would be just about, you know, the sun had already set. And his darkness is setting in. And then I've been awoken with the hand over my mouth and the hand on my chest. And I know what that means, you know, and I just open my eyes and then I know there's something there. And I would guesstimate 30 yards away, there's a bonfire going. And there's 15 or 20 VC out there cooking and eating and just having a good time. Okay? We're in this thick stuff, but we can see all that's happening. So, I reach in and we had a, I had the Medicaid meds. I was Medicaid. We had this really strong codeine. The dose was like a half a tablet to sustain cough. I gave every one of them 2, which normally would just knock anybody out.
Right.
But I knew that the adrenaline would keep them going, that the codeine would keep them, hopefully, their bodily functions from doing anything stupid, you know, like sneezing or coughing. And we just all laid there and watched and waited. And they sort of mumbled off, one guy sat there, and then I guess, I don't know, a certain time in the morning, it's still dark. They pick everything up and, you know, I mean, they were making noise. They didn't even know we were there. And they packed everything up, you know, and they start just, still dark, but you can barely stand, off they go. So, as they're moving away, okay, you know, once we make sure that they're all gone and they're not, you know, what we'll do is we'll send like two guys out just a little bit to watch while we get all of our gear together and call on a sit rep, and then we make our decision, follow them or what.
Mm-hmm.
In this one instance, the guys that were up there were like giving us a thumbs up. They could still see exactly where they were going. So we just called in a total fire full effect, and the guy said, danger close, and I said, shoot it.
Mm-hmm.
And he shot it, and that was it.
Do you have a silencer, or is this the...
No, it's artillery. Danger close means it's within 600 meters of your position.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll tell you, danger close, and I say, I don't give a... I tell them, shoot that son of a bitch.
I see.
Okay?
Yeah.
And these two guys just... And we could see it. I'd say maybe 12 to 16 rounds land within 50 meters of that position in a matter of 10 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we asked, you want a BDA, you know, bomb damage assessment, and mm-hmm. they said, no. What do you see? He said, just a bunch of shredded, everything was shredded, you know. I mean, you got bigger 155s and there's probably 12 or 16 of them land within 12 seconds, within 50 or 100 meters of their position. They're dead, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so they just chalk it up where they were and they tell us to continue the mission.
Mm-hmm.
That was smart because rather than go down there, take the chance of, who knows, you know, 8 or 10 of them sitting on the side, we don't know. And there wasn't much left of anything.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't much left of the terrain.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we know that there's not like, you know, documents that are in place and stuff like that. So it's sort of a judgment call.
Yeah.
Another time, we were doing hill humping. That's up, you got communications, down, no communications. Up, you're up and down, up and down, up and down.
Uh-huh.
And every time we would go down, right, we wouldn't have any comments. So it was a constant hump, and it was hard humping up, you know, and slippery on the way down. And we felt that we were moving too fast, and we decided to do a loop.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you know, we got our thoughts against it. Look, let's do a loop. Let's go back. You know, do a 90, loop around, okay.
Whose call was that? Was that yours or the team?
That was the team.
Okay.
The team, you know, we were just getting exhausted, and we started losing our concentration. We stopped and we said, look, you know, we are screwing up.
Mm-hmm.
We're up and down, up and down. If we get caught in a valley, we're screwed.
Mm-hmm.
So let's do a loop. So in other words, what we did is doing back down the opposite way, but not the same place. You know, we shot a 90 and went down, and then we looped around, and we came back up real slow. This took us a half a day.
Mm-hmm.
And we got back up on the side of the mountain. And the same one we started at, but a different location. And all of a sudden we heard, oh shit.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, you could see the mountain across from me.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, we seen explosions over there.
Mm-hmm.
So here, Charlie had seen our tracks and figured that we had turned around and went down, and he was shooting rockets and mortars, and he was, oh, I'd say 300 meters on the same hill as us, shooting, no, he's farther than that, but he was shooting over at the next hill, trying to catch us going up it.
Jeez.
So, what we did was, we just backed up a little bit, we pinpointed his position, and these were deep, thick mountains, you know. And I'll never forget as long as I live, because when that big old fast mover came in, I know he didn't see me, but he looked me right in the eyes and smiled as he pressed that thing and released that 500-pound bomb. And boy, that thing just took out that whole boom. I'll never forget that. I mean, it looked like he was looking me in the eyes, but he looked right at our position and smiled with his big grin, and all of a sudden you seen this huge, big 500-pound bomb right on target. And, you know, that thing just, poof, you know. And then another one behind that, and we just continued the mission, and they finally got us out because it was just, you know, it was just senseless because if you get tired, you get careless, you know, and we had been around and together long enough to stop and say, okay, we're screwing up. You know, we've been beating this bush, and if anyone's around here, they're either waiting for us or following. So we made a plan, we did a loop, and it worked. It, now there might have not been no one there, but it worked.
Hey, Joey, how does it feel, you know, there in that moment?
Yeah, it felt like an, not as good as an orgasm, but that makes your team so much tighter. Because, you know, you just look at each other and say, yeah, we are the king of the jungle. I mean, because we knew we were doing wrong. You know, we were tired. It was down and leeches and then up and combo and then down and no combo. And we knew that we were tired, frustrated, and we were getting careless.
How does it feel to know that you're being watched? Yeah, that the enemy has its sights.
Oh, yeah. At that time, we didn't know. We felt that it's possible the way we were moving that we had alerted someone and they could be waiting for us or following us. So let's do the old loop around, take our time, get our, you know, and when once we got out at the outer perimeter of the loop, we do a little resting, little eating and all, and we get our thoughts together and what do we do if, you know, and then we go back into the area. But you know, these guys must have been tracking or something, and they seen where, okay, so it was muddy and all. They think, okay, fresh tracks, yeah, they turned here, and they went back down, and they're thinking, aha, they trying to come around, ambush us, now we get them. So they figured, I guess in the time that we had moved and all. So they started slamming rockets and mortars onto the other mountains, just at basically what we would call recon by fire, just to, you know, see if they could get us to fire back. But they really thought that's where we were. And really, we were, you know, on the same side of the hill as them. Okay.
Gotta make you feel good.
Oh, yeah. It makes you feel good because now that, because everyone agrees, everyone listens, everyone understands, and everyone does their best to put the plan in effect to make it work. And when something like that happens, if you can't tear that from us, you know,
mm-hmm.
and the headquarters is listening to this, mm-hmm. you know, you're going to what? You know, and we don't explain, we just send in a SID rep. And there's some good officers up there saying, yeah, they're in some damn really rough shit. It's a damn good move because they're up and down, and every time they go down, they have no comma. So if they get caught in the down slope, they're screwed.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what they told us later. That excellent call, you know, smart move, you know, and that kind of terrain, you can only be so quiet. And after a while, I mean, you know, you got leeches all over you from being down in the bottom, and then you just, some teams might have keep on going. We were a team that had decided, I remember saying the same, I agree, we are screwing up, guys.
Mm-hmm.
We have been humping for a couple hours now, and we don't really know what the fuck. Is that the next bottom of the next valley?
And you have no radio contact down there.
Right. So we did the old, you know, cowboy and Indian thing, you know, mm-hmm. or whatever you want to call it. And by that time, we not only that, we were rested. We had our gear rearranged. We had the leech's office. And now we were going to be the hunter,
mm-hmm.
and not the hunted.
So you called in the world on them.
You call in a couple of them. You can forget it because they have that mountain is gone.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Now on the guys that were at the campfire, now we called artillery on them because, and depending on your location, you have. So many supporting units. You might have Arvin artillery, American artillery, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If you have some close artillery, especially American, you want to work with them because it's more of a silent kill than the aircraft coming in,
mm-hmm.
you know? And because we knew where we were, we had. Because when we set up, we gave our position and everything like that. And these guys were just on a stroll, you know. And we just let them get far enough out. But when I called it in, the guy said, danger close. And I said, shoot it.
Mm-hmm.
And he knows who he's talking to.
Mm-hmm.
And when we say shoot it, they shoot it. And when you talk a fire effect and you got a battery shooting, you're going to get at least 12 to 36, but maybe 12 to 16 rounds within 12 seconds within 50 to 100 meters of that position.
Mm-hmm.
And there was only about 15 to 20 of that. There was no sense in doing any damage to body, I mean, bomb damage assessment or anything because the terrain was just a big hole.
Right.
So,
was there any chance of any stragglers being left around? Would
maybe,
you go looking?
Maybe, but you know, they gave us a body count of 12 or 15, whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, in an ambush, it's different. Now, an ambush, you crawl up and you try to get documents. You never stand up in an ambush. And then you try to get as much as you can off and pop anybody that's not up dead and then crawl back in and get the hell out of there. But on something like this, or something like the one where they had the campfire, or the one where they were shooting both of the same mountain,
mm-hmm.
You know, you let them get far enough away and you fall in the biggest shit around,
mm-hmm.
that if they're alive, they can hear, they're bleeding from the nose, and they're bumping in the trees. I guarantee you that.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So Why jeopardize your mission? They don't know what hit them. So you take off and continue your mission. You see what I'm getting at?
Yep. Oh, yeah.
And then if any of their friends come, they don't know what they're at.
Mm-hmm.
And we had interceptors, you know, they had listeners. And I don't know when it came down. There's so many different tales about it, but eventually they started. Now, this could have been their way of propaganda to reverse psychology, that they were the NBA and DC, primarily the NBA, were training LERP hunter-killer teams. So whenever, they didn't call, what they call the condos, that was the translation. The condo teams in the area beyond the LERP. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we would get a classified line that would be, you know, like a certain, a special line for any special instruction. And they might say, radio interception, say, recondo teams in the area. That means that, that could mean that they have spotted you already and they're just watching. And like I said, if you don't go after their water or their women and you don't see anything that can compromise them,
mm-hmm.
I know that they'll let you go. Rather than jeopardize hitting these four or five guys with a couple calls and call in the whole world,
mm-hmm.
and jeopardize their, maybe, who knows, well, that communication bunker, which we never made it to, by the way, because they hit us in the morning,
mm-hmm.
They and Ali, that when they get in that thing, you could drive Houston half to it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I mean, that's how big it was.
Yeah.
But since we had found it forward, let's say, from the trail markings and all, we felt that we were close and probably sitting on it. What they did was, and my plan was, we will, instead of going up the saddle, we're going to go around the whole mountain, the hard way, you know, okay, but at least we'll have, you know, the cover, go around the side of the mountain and see if we can find anything, because I don't think we're going to have, you know, like a parking lot sign on top, but they spent the whole night just creeping in, and then at first light, poof, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we were on the side of the mountain.
Right.
So that's when I called for medevac, and they said, well, he's going. And I had to get the guys, you know, they killed the team leader, and it was just, you know, almost overran us. And we got out with rope ladders and the wire rigging and stuff like that, and then just called in everything that was, you know, available, and then they did a reaction. Well, what they do is they put a company in the next day to see what, you know, happened, and they said, you know, this really was a collapse, huge tunnel. You have to figure that they've been digging in for almost 40 years.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Since the French.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they had underground tunnel systems that were elaborate. They had mountains that were inside, that were, you know, hospital operating rooms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so. But the way we felt, once you had a good team, okay, I would much rather be with five men any day than with 50 or 150 men that are going to come slamming in on their helicopters and banging and chopping their way through that bush to go find Charlie, because Charlie's been watching you since you landed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, well, if you ever read my, because everybody, some guy kept on calling me Dolphin, and he's a good friend of mine, I said, Rocky, that's not my name. Dolphin, remember?
Yes.
Stay
yep.
alert, stay alive.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Oh, okay, that's it. And I wonder why you always say salsa above your signature block.
Right.
And I said, that's, you know, stay alert, stay alive. You know? If you had. Now, then we had. I know we're going to finish up, so.
Yeah, that's fine. Go ahead.
Then, when we started getting the shorties. Personnel,
uh-huh.
That's when we started putting in the Kid Carson scout.
Right.
And being around, to me, like the SF, you have got, it doesn't matter whether you like the people or not, you are the guest in their nation. And you are giving them and providing them with whatever you're supposed to provide them with.
Joe, do you think that was hard for Americans to kind of figure that out and
no,
live by?
It was hard for the lurks. Because most of them came from common grunt backgrounds, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They lurked with their brothers, and mm-hmm. now they got these two hoy guys that used to be in the NBA and you know, the Vietnamese Army, and they didn't trust them. And to them, everybody was a gook. A gook is a gook is a gook.
Mm-hmm.
Where the team that I was supposed to go to went on the third tour, they, because of border operations, there might be three Americans and five or six mountain guys.
Mm-hmm.
And they lived, eat, breathe, and spoke the language, and ate the food. And they were, you know, the most dependable indigenous personnel you could find.
Mm-hmm.
So it was tough at first. Well, these guys didn't want nothing to do with them. You know, they didn't trust them. They figured they'd lead them into ambushes. So it was a rough transition. I was around right before I left, and you know, several of the guys who had worked with ESF and with indigenous personnel before, you know, said, these guys will definitely, you'll know, as soon as you get out there, you know, you're going to think you're quiet, they're going to make you look like an asshole, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They move so good, they're walking up front. So, number one, if you ever, which we never did, but if you ever run into a friendly patrol, they'll get killed first,
mm-hmm.
okay,
mm-hmm.
accidentally.
Mm-hmm.
And if you run into an enemy patrol, they're going to be up front. And, you know, you're just going to have to work with them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've got, we lost a couple of them, and we've got them, you know, honored them, or I should say, acknowledge them by putting them on our wall of our KIAs in our units with,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I mention them. See, every month I do a report. I started it, and I did it for a year. I wanted people to remember, so at the end of the month, as the new month begins, like November's coming, I'm saying, I would say something like, okay, you know, this week, you know, or this month, we're going to be celebrating Veterans Day, you know, so we have to remember to support our troops and remember our veterans.
Right.
And we can never forget our warrior brothers who died in the month of November. I do it by month, not by year.
Mm-hmm.
And then I say, during the month of November, starting so-and-so, and so-and-so, starting so-and-so, God bless our troops and their families, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
That's really, you know, So then I wrote and said I was going to stop doing it because I had completed the year and I got a lot of people. And no, no, don't do it because people jump in your site occasionally, and when they see the name, then they contact me. And then that's what happened with the virtual wall when I put a face with every name up there when they had that program with Kinko. It was like maybe 2001.
Mm-hmm.
They, in the virtual wall, you know, the one up at where the Vietnam Veterans Wall.
Mm-hmm.
Vietnam Veterans Memorial Foundation.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. They had a program for the face with a name, and Kinko was supporting it, so you could go in there and use their computer, and they had the format and all. And I was in there over 6 hours, and just using their format just to get it set up, and it didn't cost me a dime, and they're 18, 20 bucks an hour. And I asked the lady when I was in there, I said, you know, how many people have been up here doing it? She said, you're the first one.
Wow.
So then she said, you know, it's brand new, so we're going to have to work with it. And I thought it was a one deal shot. Once we got it locked in, we'd be good. So I put the name, picture, and it had to be a disc for picture and a disc for text.
Mm-hmm.
So I entered a picture in each one's profile, and then I left the remembrance from us, and it automatically puts their picture from the profile down on the remembrance. And what I wanted to do was put in the remembrance just a short bio of what our unit is all about. So, and I want it, and it's done now, 2-3 years of research and doing it, because what was happening was the next guy, they opened it up to everybody after a while, Joe Blow come along and he would put in a remembrance and a photo and it would knock my photo out, and then we'd have our guy there stand there with his arm around his guy drinking a beer.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked it out. I would notify him and say, you know, I'd appreciate it, you know, if you would remove it. If not, then, you know, if it's a unit endeavor. So I'd end up on. Now, if mom sends a picture, right, and she puts it up there, and in her remembrance, she usually say, like, my beloved son or whatever,
mm-hmm.
then it stays.
It goes.
It stays. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I eventually worked it out where the remembrance was from, it's called Ranger Brother from E20 75th Ranger. You click on that and it takes the family or whoever to a real nice unit patch, and then a short explanation of what their son unit was all about. And it's come out. It's just awesome because they don't know what he did or anything. And it's basically what I told you our unit was about. You know, highly motivated, trained soldiers that only the best of the best, and, you know, the missions that we did and stuff like that. It's got a really nice patch with the two scrolls over it and all. And it took me 3 years, you know, to get it right. And it's right. Nobody's entered a picture except for a couple mothers, and that picture only remains with their remembrance and on the profile. My remembrance stays the same. I got pretty good. What I did was I formally wrote to these people, whoever they are, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I wrote them that on behalf of our unit, we want to thank you for your dedication and professionalism of a job, an unsung, you know, unheard of job that nobody knows who you are, where you're at. And I know that I've put you through hell, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote him a really nice professional with the cover letter and the whole bit, explaining that our unit appreciates and understands how hard your job is.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a guy gets that, the NCOIC or UIC, hey, man, that's nice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this guy doesn't know us. We're sitting in the bottom of some goddamn computer think tank, you know, and they don't know nothing. They just, oh man, I would make 20 changes a night, you know, and I sent that, and I did it on my own. I CC'd the bosses. He said, oh, good job. After that, geez, my stuff was just clicking. You know?
Yeah.
I would just, and I didn't do that for that purpose, but whenever I have a problem, it is automatically fixed because I specifically state what I want. And I'll bet you, I know if I was the NCOIC, I would have framed that.
Yeah.
Because I would say, look, we are important people, and this is a retired person. You think some Joe Bros are being, this guy knows how important your work is and how hard we are working. So, you know.
Joey, how important is it for you now, looking back, to not only remember and talk about your experiences, but to remember those who served beside you and those who didn't come back with you?
Well, that's my goal, is the guys begin to make it. See, we're dinosaurs. We are going to not be here.
Mm-hmm.
So our website will dissolve. We was going to go to our parent unit,
mm-hmm.
but we have decided to give it to you. And I'm sure Roy and you have talked about how that has to go about, because we want a perpetual, historical, a professional site for people to go and forever see us.
Mm-hmm.
And the 75th has got a pretty good site, but they're having a hard enough time managing. They're trying to manage every unit from Vietnam to the present.
Mm-hmm.
So I have developed a format. Well, they developed a format. So I have on every man, I have their picture, their profile, which is all their personal information. Then I have their virtual wall profile. Then I have their full casualty report.
Mm-hmm.
Then I have their virtual wall profile, their virtual wall remembrance.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have a picture of the brick on our remains Ranger Memorial. Okay, and then I have a pencil essence, mm-hmm. for every man. So you can open it up, and when you open up one, there's three men in a packet. When you open it up, picking out one man, that's what you're going to see. His name, his profile, gives all this pertinent information. His casualty status gives him all that. And then the Vietnam War and remembrance, and also what I want to see happen is that if you put, and plus I've got two or three dozen really great photos that coincide with our unit. And what I would like to do is have them turn it into basically a slide show.
Mm-hmm.
Not like you could go to a reunion,
mm-hmm.
and someone who wanted to sit down and, you know, see what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
because they would do it for us. And these people, and not only that, the Rangers of today and the Rangers of the future are going to always be looking at what we've done.
Mm-hmm.
And I want them to see
take your time.
I want them never to forget. You know, if it wasn't for the guy on your left and right, he might not be.
Yeah.
So, that's basically what I have done, and all you're missing now, and a remembrance curve in each one of them, is I want them to build, is my recommendation. I've given you all everything. All you have to do is put on a program. So when you go to a reunion, you go to a meeting, the guys, the families, and we have Gold Star wives, we have Gold Star moms that come to our reunion. Okay? And I mean, they write me all the time, you know, about when I do something or when I put them on the wall, whatever. And I've never met them, but the thing is, if they see this, and you can even add music, see, you know, you have a couple pictures of the, and, you know, the unit patch, and then you have the memorial brick that they're laid in down at Eastern SOCOM, where they're all on one wall. And then the first man comes on, and you see his picture, and you read about him, and the virtual wall, the pencil etching, and things like that. And then the next guy, and a couple pictures, and stuff like that. So it's portable, okay? Mm-hmm. And it also can be, there is a program that can be put on the website, which does exactly that. Instead of having the wall alphabetically, you know, you click on it. Now you can go anywhere you want on it, but you click on it and it just runs just like that. And you hold it as long as you want. You can read, you can see the picture of the guy, you can read all this information, the remembrances of, you know, what his buddy wrote about him, what his job was, where he got killed, how he got killed. And then his profile from the virtual wall, his remembrance from the virtual wall, his brick at the Ranger Memorial, pencil etching, personal stuff that, you know, that we just don't forget, you know. And they would do it for us, that's what I say, and that's why I have challenged, I just wrote an article for the newsletter that, you know, I've asked for remembrances since I started this. Now, I've been in the virtual wall and I've seen plenty of remembrances left there. So, I've done a couple of remembrances on some of them. So, I said, all you have to do is look at it and you'll see. It's not how long it is, it's how meaningful. And really there isn't that much space for remembrance in the profile that we have. It's enough to say, you know, who he was, what kind of guy he was, and how he helped the unit, and how he was, you know, what he was all about. You know, so that's the only thing we're lacking, but I told them that we needed this because we would eventually transfer everything over to the 75th. Well, when Dan told me, well, you know we're not going to do that, I said, well, can I be honest with him and tell him? And he said, yeah, damn right. I said, good. So I told him that, you know, we would have been planning to get this and, you know, plus the 75th, sent over the format, we did the format and all that, and I know I'm way ahead of everybody because I put the damn stuff in March of this year, and they hadn't posted any of it. So what I did is now they had the list of our KIAs, which have changed because we had a man on there that wasn't even in our unit. But due to lack of records, plus a classification, seven guys named the same, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And he got mixed up with another guy who was killed, but he was killed in a training accident.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to, I went down and found the guy's grave site, and we talked to the guy's members of his team, who he got killed with and all. Well, what I did was I went in, and I didn't know I could do this, but I pulled up our KIA list.
Mm-hmm.
And this was 3 or 4 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
I said, damn, they haven't even changed that. So I just tried to type on it.
Mm-hmm.
Boom. So it gave it to me. Now I edited it. Okay,
mm-hmm.
And I changed it all around, and I put everything in there perfectly. I just couldn't, I didn't know how to get it back into their web. So what I did was I just saved it and closed it, and their web went back the way it was supposed to be, right, originally.
Right.
But then I had to change it, so then I sent it up to the boss and told him, this is what we got, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so we sent it to the 75th, and it had everything. It had our scroll. I just took the web page right off, and I just rearranged the names and everything, got all right. But I didn't have the knowledge of putting it back on, or maybe they have a setup that you can't. You know how you can copy something that you can't enter, but. You know, I edited it, and so I saved it on a disk, and then I sent it up to them, and, you know, but that's when I told them, I said, we need to tell them because, you know, and then we, of course, you guys walk on water, whether you know it or not, but, you know, we did, you know, my collection was sent up there as a test.
Right.
And we was up there 2 years before we decided, yeah, we want to commit. Now they just released 2,000 documents.
Mm-hmm.
And now we need to go up there and get them.
Mm-hmm.
And go through all them.
Mm-hmm.
Then whatever's relevant will still come to you, and within the next several years they'll release a couple thousand more. And we want to get everything that pertains to our unit. That you know, needs to be in there into your site.
Right.
And, of course, that's between you and Dan, of how you do it legally and
mm-hmm.
all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But we told him that we ain't giving this shit to 75th. 75th called me, wrote me, and told me to send him the information, and I said, I am not sending no one information.
Mm-hmm.
I will do the research. We will do it as a unit, so it will be done our way, and we, this way, we'll have unit cohesiveness, and we will know what the final product is.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That's when we thought we were going to go there. And so I finally told him in the newsletter that now, even more so, we need the remembrances because eventually we're going to transfer. And I gave him your website
mm-hmm.
and basically the directions of how to work it,
mm-hmm.
which is really neat once you learn the little box.
Mm-hmm.
Scroll down there, whatever you like, put a click on the box.
Yep.
When you're all done, hit, you know, that thing, display what I click.
Yes.
That is fantastic.
Yes. Well, that's
what you got
to
learn.
That's a tribute to Justin Sample, the webmaster.
But see, that's what you have to learn. And so I have a format written out.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody wants to go, I can either email it to them, whatever, and it makes it so much easier for them to zip through it. And it may, once I learned it, I said, oh, okay, now display search results. Boom. Okay. Hit that. Display selected whatever items, whatever, and
mm-hmm.
they line up, and boy, you can just go through them, and it's nice.
Because
when you see 780 damn files facing you, and I told them, don't expect to do it in a day. Take you know, take a few pages or five pages at a day, a time, and click off the ones you want. And then, you know, so I have a format now so they don't get lost or, you know, say, man, 750 freaking. And it's going to go up into the thousands, you know, hopefully.
Well,
that's my main thing, but see, I was in the beginning, I'm membership number 3. I was also on active duty, and I had a part in helping the Rangers, the regular Rangers, when you open their annual Ranger book, the history of the Rangers, they would have 7, 8, 9 pictures of World War II, 7, 8, 9 pictures of Korea, 2 pictures of Vietnam, and then the beginning of the 1st Battalion. So, wait a minute, there's 10 years of Lurban and Ranger in there, and used the 1st Battalion, took the heritage from my company. So I went down there and I helped them integrate the Vietnam era Rangers and Lurk's history into theirs. But they, we can't be part of their lineage because we were assigned the parent unit. Now they can draw our lineage, okay, but we can be a part of their history. And that's what we are, so that's integrated in there. So I help do that. And whenever they're gonna put the KIA list in stone, which they did at the Ranger Memorial and then down at the Special Operations Command Memorial in MacDill Air Force Base, they came to me. And we went back and forth with Side Job. Well, we've come to find out that once we got to know each other, he used to be the Special Forces Museum director years ago when I was in the service, and we had done some work together. So it went back and forth, and my list came out on top. And there wasn't a list. I said, when you put it in stone, it's got to be exact. It cannot be, there cannot be a mistake, you know? And so it went back and forth, and we put it in, and it's beautiful. I mean, they put it in one big, huge wall, 31 names. It's beautiful. And so that's what I've really dedicated myself to. The history part is done, basically. It's a matter of confirming that with and adding to it with actual after-action reports and all. But we're going to have a hard time, and I try to tell them, don't keep your hopes up, because we're with the 173rd. When we send it up to the G2, it goes into the 173rd report.
Right.
Okay. And it's real hard for us to track down after action reports, specifically for any operation, because unless you know exactly what day, where you was at, and who you was with, you know, and if it's a division or brigade or I should say division, then you're going to have to buy all that, you know, the reports from that division to try to find out if your after action reports in there. And I know a guy who worked in our unit in the AAR, and the AARs were written a little bit different than the way the teams were reported due to classification and or what people wanted to hear and read than what we really did. So, you know, we don't know what's up there. We just know, I talked to a guy who built a site, and he said, with 4-man teams, 2 copying, 2 proofreading, all day. You can actually reserve computers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, copiers. He said, if you get 1,000 documents, you're lucky. And that's from 8 to 5. He said, we go back the next day and do it again. And that's with two good proofreaders and two copy guys. And that's balls of the wall from 8 to 5, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, you come across shit like, you know, daily inventories and... You might go through 300 or 400 pages and get 5 pages that, you know. So,
yeah.
We don't know.
Well, Joey, why don't we take a break for today and we'll pick
okay.
up another time, okay?
All right.
This is Dr. Richard Perrone continuing my oral history interview with Joey Welsh. Today is November 28, 2005, and we are continuing what we began a few months back. Joey, let's talk today about some general topics and thinking about the whole American Army in general and then about your unit. How would you gauge the morale of what you saw, what you experienced over there?
Funny you asked that because we were discussing that last night in reference to, well, what we have is we've just put a little format chat site together.
Mm-hmm.
It's private. It's only for the guys in the company you sign on, and you do what you want to do. It's for PTSD guys.
Mm-hmm.
And those of us who came from a line grunt company to E company, it's an entirely different war, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because usually the highest rank, if we had E4s, E5s, that was it. They ran the team, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of responsibility. And not only that, the training, you had to be a three-time volunteer, really.
Mm-hmm.
You had to volunteer for airborne, you had to volunteer for the unit, and volunteer for Vietnam, you know, because they, you know,
mm-hmm.
basically you had to be in combat 6 months before you can even apply, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And some guys, like I was just telling you about, spend 4 or 5 years going from unit to unit. And you ever see me answer my... put my little slogan down there.
Mm-hmm.
Salsa
mm-hmm.
is one of them.
Yes.
Salsa. Okay. Well, people thought that was my name, so I had to tell them that stay alert, stay alive.
Mm-hmm.
Because you look at it like this. If you're going into Jolly's country, who's been there 30 years fighting,
mm-hmm.
that's why we never infill between 11 and 2. Because that's Charlie's part time. He sits up on the mountains and he watches these 200 man companies coming in, these 22 huge machines, flying them in. They watch where they land. They get, watch them get off. They watch where they go. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
Okay. Now, of course, you know that. So, you know, but you're on a search and destroy. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Where in our case, we're going in maybe 9 in the morning, maybe 4 in the afternoon, one single ship just flying around. We're dipping and diving like he's, you know, just doing a thing. And we dip once, we don't get off, we dip the second time, we get off, we dip the third, he dips a third time, he dips a fourth time. In the meantime, I'm sitting perfectly still 15, 20 minutes
mm-hmm.
to get smell, feel, you know, and taste of what my surroundings are. Everything's good. The CNC ship that's way out there, I give them the okay sign, and that's it. We're infilled. And then we slowly, never talking, start moving.
Right.
I might move for 10 minutes. I might move for 20. And then we'll stop. There's no talking. It's just... Americans don't have the patience to do that.
Mm-hmm.
They don't.
Did the enemy kind of assume that or know that? Do you
think? No. It finally caught on that they put out LERP Hunter Killer Team,
mm-hmm.
Same way with SOG.
Mm-hmm.
They had SOG trained used dogs, everything, mm-hmm. to try to get them, you know,
mm-hmm.
Because they're so dangerous. Because our job at the beginning, primarily if you're doing a recon job, and, you know, you've got intel from a very, very high level at our Corps, right?
Mm-hmm.
So rather than send in 200 people and scare them off or waste to somebody out and get them killed, let's go out and do a long-range reconnaissance, since we're doing this long-range plan, and have them recon it, bring all the intel back, and then we'll be able to react to it, okay, and know what ways to come in, how to come in, and stuff like that. It's like a pre-assault, you know, a vanguard. But sometimes you don't get to land because even you fly over it the day before and you decide where you want to go in. And if you get shot out of that one and you're still flying, you've got to go into another area,
mm-hmm.
another place, you know. But anyway, once you're on the move, and if you have a good team that works together, that knows, they just feel everything,
mm-hmm.
You know, you're just more alive and alert than anything in the world. You know, mm-hmm. there's, you know, nothing more that can keep you like that. And we moved, and we only got on radio 4 times. And so, things could go really great, or things could go really bad. When they went really bad, the whole team would be out. And that went with, from us, who had 4 or 5, to Saab, who had 11 or 15. Just totally overrun, that's it, you're done.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
So, you know, so you paid attention, you did your homework, you've got to outsmart the guy, even though you're in his backyard.
So you all were confident.
And so we were cocky. Competent, you had to be cocky,
uh-huh.
okay? We were very, very competent. If, you know, the long, like in SOG, if you made it to 20 missions, you better quit because you're going to die.
Mm-hmm.
You've beaten the odds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, us, our ratio was like 1 to 55. So for every one of us, we got 55 of them. Side was like 150. Well, you know, but, you know, they were had a bigger target. Bigger target. But our morale and our esprit de corps was really, really, really high. I mean, you know, we wore tiger fatigues. We didn't, you know, we just wore tiger fatigues or Tammany's fatigues. We didn't follow nobody's rules. Everybody left us alone if they were smart. They didn't know who we were with because the only people that did that were SOG, SF, and LERPs, you know. You know, we had jungle fatigues, real nice and stuff sewed on just in case. Or if you wanted to get, you know, pushed up to go downtown and get sweaty and dirty, you know?
Yeah.
You know, put all your scare badges and terror tags. That's what I call them. Scare badges and terror.
Why did you call them that?
I don't know. It just came out of my mouth one day. I was teaching somebody, you know, and they're all, I said, what are you looking at?
Mm-hmm.
And they said, look at all the badges you got. I said, oh, you mean these scare badges and terror tags? I mean, like, I said, that doesn't make it,
mm-hmm.
you know? I said, you know, they had a sale on the PX. I brought them. You don't know what the hell you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they're like, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I said, you know, it's not what you did and what you're wearing. It's what you're doing now and how I am going to train you now. I don't live off of what I've done. I try to keep you alive off of what I lived through.
Mm-hmm.
That was my psychology and my philosophy when I came back into service.
Right.
And that's why I pushed my troops hard, but I was fair, you know. And I tried to give everything and learn everything and be the best at everything. I was very, very, very obsessive with being on top. And that's the way the majority of the company, guys in the company were. Mm-hmm. They wanted to be better than the next guy, mm-hmm. you know. And, you know, nobody's to say who's the best. One day you're on, one day you're off, you know. it's that you learn from your mistakes and you try not to lose anybody. And you never leave anybody behind, but sometimes you have to. But, I mean, they'll stay there and fight to almost to death to get a dead guy out, you know?
Yeah.
That's where now you're coming with a large company. You've got 150 guys, they're going in there, and that's why, the reason why the statistics show that the average grunt that served all in World War II or all of Korean War only seen 44 days of combat compared to a 1 year tour with a grunt that seen 230 was because of the air mobility of the chopper to get him from point A to point B so much. That's the reason, and that's a true statistic. The air mobility gave us the opportunity to jump out of one place, get on the chopper, and move you to another spot where they know it's hot. And that's what they do with the grunts. They just move them from spot to spot, chasing the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Until the enemy, you know, gets caught or says, no, wait a minute, we're going to catch you. And so, you know, they know you're coming. But in our case, a good thing we used to do was called stay behind. Either a team would be getting out and we'd get off, but it's nice when, like, a company will leave an area and as they're getting on, a team will get off and they'll set up. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And they'll set up, because they know once the Americans are gone, they're going to go down there and find out what they left behind, because G.I. Joe left everything,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they'll come maybe to down, stay there four or five, stay there 800 meters down there in the drop zone. Just let them build up, and then you just, you know, recon them or slam them with air. I mean, it worked every time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was just a lot of different things that we did. And the thing was, when we started getting, we were authorized 7 6-man teams in 4 platoons. We were the largest company because we were core level. And when they formed, half of the guys had 6 months in combat and half were new.
Mm-hmm.
Now, after they, by the time they finished training, management should have understood that once they get down to 30 days, they're not going. Once you've got 30 days left in LERPs, you can't go on a mission.
Mm-hmm.
You're a hazard to the team, you know. So they should have had guys coming in. They started operation. They formed in September. They started operations in December. They should have had people coming in by February or March, because the guys are getting ready to leave in August and September, if they wanted to all leave, if they were still there.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm getting at?
Mm-hmm.
So we had a lull there for a good 6-8 months to where we were running maybe 4 6-man teams or 5 5-man teams, which is not bad as long as it's the same guy. Okay?
Right.
It's when you start switching, because it takes you a couple times to get used to each other,
mm-hmm.
that it was frustrating, you know, and there's just nothing you could do about it. You wanted to be, you know, with that team, but you also didn't want your buddy to have to go out with a bunch of new guys, so you wanted to help out over there, too. So, you know, our street decor morale was high. Nobody messed with us. You know, none of the officers, none of the NCOs, nobody ever harassed us or anything like that. You do your job, you come back, you rest, now you support that next team gets out there, and then you get ready to take his place while the other guy's resting for a few days. It was like a cycle thing. Mm-hmm. You'd isolate, do the mission, you detox, support, isolate, do the mission, detox, support. It was just non-stop. And we were supposed to be formed that we would all move together, but eventually it was too good of a thing. They took a platoon and they put a platoon with the South Vietnamese Army doing stuff for them, or a platoon with the 4th Infantry Division doing stuff for them. We're talking long range patrol. We did some cross border operations when we were working with Omega.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
What is that?
Okay. Well, you heard of Project Delta.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Delta, Sigma, Omega. All mm-hmm. that was you had these SOG units were CCN, which was Command and Control North, CCC, Command and Control Center, and CCS, Command and Control South. Well, as soon as they crossed the border and started doing operations, they called that team Project Delta. It was really a code saying that that's what they were doing. And then Project Sigma and then Project Omega when they started going across. And we were formed, you know, the Corps LERPs, to relieve them from the South Vietnam area and let them do that cross-border operations more. So we took up their areas. The Special Forces was running the in-country recon at the time, and we took it over, and then they started doing more cross-border operations. And that's really what Delta, Sigma, and Omega was. That's declassified now,
yes.
Of course, you know, but that's what it was. We slackened, and we were formed so that they could go into Omega, meaning that Command and Control Central, and let's just cut it in three, you know, sections, north, middle, and south, TCC, could go over, start going into Cambodia and Laos.
Mm-hmm.
And then CCN was Laos and North Vietnam. And CCS was down in Cambodia and stuff like that. That's why them names, that's all the names meant. They think it means that they did, you know, they just, you know, like they call SOG. And it was really studies and observation group.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but, you know, but there was a lot of things that a lot of people still don't know. And that's a shame in a way because, have you read that book,
mm-hmm.
SOG?
Mm-hmm. By John Plaster, yes.
Okay, well, Colonel Howard is mentioned in there many times. In fact, I believe it was in that book. I know they talk about him in the book several times. And also Dick Meadows. I know Dick. Zabinski, whatever his name was. Well, anyway, they were the most decorated unit in Vietnam. They had 4 Medal of Honor winners. Recipients, I mean, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Their kill ratio and their statistics was beyond anything ever happened in any war, in the ratio wise. Mm-hmm. However, nobody knew about it. Okay,
mm-hmm.
Nobody was supposed to know about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. This will be a great opportunity for you to kind of clear some of that stuff up to make sure
yeah.
people do know about it.
Yeah. Well, like I was saying, you know, they've opened up a lot of people now. When John wrote his book, in fact, he's, you know, good friends with Colonel Howard, and he mentions him in there. He was put in, the only man to ever be put in for the Medal of Honor 3 times within 13 months.
Mm-hmm.
And his men all said he should have got it. He got 9 Purple Hearts.
Wow.
Okay. There wasn't I think they had 110% wounded.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I mean, everybody was hit. And these guys would get hit and just, you know, heal up and go back out.
Mm-hmm.
But his bio, see, that's when you see his bio, and then when you read his duty assignments, slowly as you get around, you'll see a Company C and Company C right next to each other. That's us in the middle. Because he went from, like I said, from enlisted for 12 years to an officer's position, you know. But he was just a hard man. And, well, Dick Meadows was they were all renowned for something. Dick Meadows was the top prison snatcher.
Mm-hmm.
If you wanted a prisoner, you sent Dick. You know,
yeah.
I mean, he'd come back, you know, and they also had, in 1995, they finally awarded a few guys combat jumps for the halo jumps they were doing in 68. They finally recognized them as, yes, okay, they were halo, and the only ones ever done in the history of the United States Armed Forces.
Yeah.
1995, they finally said, okay. You know, see, they'd done them, a few of them, and, you know, they weren't doing too good. I mean, they had round shoots and,
mm-hmm.
you know, but as things got better, you know, they were pulling off, they were sliding in at 15,000 feet. They were seeing the enemy, destroying them, and leaving without ever leaving a trace. And they were surrounded by maybe a regiment.
Mm.
You know, it's a picture-perfect thing, some of the things. Then again, some of them went in and, you know, stuff went twisting and flying and they got lost. And so it's just, you know, that's why I wanted to stay. I wanted to go into B Company 5th Group, which was in the Central Highlands,
mm-hmm.
where I was in Blake 2. And I would have been working with the yards, probably, or an alert team. That's what they call them.
Mm-hmm.
Which the yards, the yards, and there was then the Hungs, they call them. They were Chinese descent.
Can you say that name again?
H-U-N-G-S.
Right.
Hung. I'm not saying it directly. I speak Thai, but not Vietnamese. Mountain yards were the mountain dwelling people, okay, that, evolved
mm-hmm.
there. And there was a couple different races of them. The Hungs are the ones that the SF took for SOG.
Mm-hmm.
Them and deserters from the NVA Army and the VC.
Why take this particular Montagnard group?
Well, because they were, they were of a Chinese descent, and they're, it's just like a mountain yard. Why do you take a mountain yard? Well, because he's been walking up and down the mountains his whole life in his bare feet. He's strong,
mm-hmm.
he's quiet, he knows the land, he knows if it's right or wrong, he knows how to live in the land. He moves like, a panther, you know, he's
mm-hmm.
strong as an ox, okay,
mm-hmm.
and he's proud of his village and he'll defend his village and his country. Of course, the country didn't give a darn about him. You know, basically, they almost pulled genocide. There was almost a genocide on him. I mean, we have villages we helped establish the special forces as a whole. We had big mountain yard villages in the States because they fought with them for 15 years.
Right.
And they were not going to leave them behind. They went back and got lots of them. I mean, they went right after them. you know, that's the first thing people they hit when they cross the border. The South Vietnamese ran. They ran. I mean, that's it. They dumped the stuff and that's it. They were gone.
Was that a common experience?
No, I'm saying when we left. Oh, yeah. They didn't get far because you never can tell which way the bullets fly, and somebody, they usually wind up getting killed if they ran because they're exposing themselves to fire. You know what I'm saying? You never know which way the bullets are flying in the jungle. You have to be careful who you piss off.
Right. did you have some strange experiences where you didn't know who was shooting at you?
Well, I knew it wasn't my people shooting at me, but I didn't know who the hell it was, and they were shooting all over the place. And it's comical now, but I bumped into guys. Oh! You know, and it was the enemy, you know, trying to get, wait a minute, we're jockeying for position. Okay, that's not good, but it's not bad because it was sort of a simultaneous finding each other. Okay, and it chooses to put this on the draw. Now, if he doesn't have a big reinforcement, we're going to win, and he knows that, so he'll run. But if he has big reinforcements, he'll back up and try to entice us into a trap. But they know they got to do it fast because we got everything coming.
Right.
One thing we had is we got everything coming. But Sog suffered from that also because the Air Force squadron from Thailand, the Blackbirds, they were all, you know, everything was painted black. They were supposed to support them. And we didn't have aviation support like one of our sister's companies did. If you have aviation support that live, breathe, and eat with you and take you to combat or take you to work and pick you up, they fly harder, they try harder, they work harder, yeah, they love you harder. That's just the way it is. You know, that's it. And, you know, God bless them chopper pilots, but they didn't even know who we were. And they had the tenacity and the balls to hang out there and really try to, you know, take care of it.
Would you all try to foster that relationship with these units?
Oh, I do. That's why when I heard it was going on and my friend said, you think you could help out and publicizing since you know San Antonio, I said, heck yeah, it'd be an honor. You know, I mean, every VFW and every organization I knew, I alerted to the fact, you know, and I helped publicize. And a friend of mine works in the Veterans Affair Committee downtown, and so he pushed it throughout the military system here. And well, there's another one for you. What happened is if you go to www.intheshadowoftheblade.com right now, as soon as it opens, it takes a while, but as soon as it opens and it says blog news, BLOGNEWS, you click on that because it's a new thing. Someone stole their guest book. As some hacker. So when you blog it, it's going to take you over to New Braunfels, Texas, and everything's all about, you know, you can find all about the movie, the documentary on that site, okay? But you can only just see limited. You switch over to this blog site and you see where it's actually being held and what the results, final, you know, results, most recent results of it. And that's what they've been doing. I mean, you know, they've won so many awards and all. And you see, them guys, actually, they got it from here because they refurbished it and it was in the Texas State Museum. And they leased it. They leased that chopper. And got all the pilots, former pilots, to fly it. And if you look at it real close, one side says Marine on the tail end, and on the other side it says U.S. Army. People didn't recognize that. And that was just sort of combined, you know, the forces. And I said, well, where'd you put the Air Force and Navy on the skids or why? You know, but they didn't, you know. But, yeah, he refurbished it. In fact, one of the guys who was there, well, I met the first guy through the harmonica thing. And then another guy who was putting it on, he lives up north. And another fellow who was part of it, he's the only helicopter service in San Antonio.
Mm-hmm.
I just found out what got all this. And he does some fantastic, beautiful aerial photography and not just sightseeing, but a lot of working in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife and I are going up on a birthday flight.
Mm-hmm.
And takeoff time will be at sunset. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll catch the sunset and then the lights coming on and all. It's only about a 30-minute ride. And we picked the route where we would like to go. And he'll take me and stop and take pictures and do anything I want. You know, he said, you know, you tell me what you want in 30 minutes or an hour or whatever you want. You know,
mm-hmm.
And it's just a 3-seater, you know, and he has access to a 5-seater too. You know, I fired up about it, and I really wanted to go when I found that. He's got a really good business going. He's the only guy there since 1985.
Mm-hmm.
And God bless the chopper pilots. I mean, the comments I made was, you know, I congratulated Cliff, John, and JJ, you know, and the rest of the crew for making this happen. And, you know, I was, appreciated the fact that I could help, and I didn't take it as a task. I took it as an honor to help.
How often?
Because if it wasn't for them, I know on several occasions I would either be dead or missing. And there's no doubt in my military mind, if it wasn't for that chopper, many, 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 many lurks can tell you the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
If they weren't there, I'd be dead or missing, at a minimum.
Yeah.
There's just no way. You can't run forever,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, you've seen Bat 21, right?
Mm-hmm.
What they do, they lost 5 choppers, 16, 20 people killed to get one man out.
Yeah.
You see?
And that's realistic. That is what those guys would do for you.
Oh, yeah. Well, see, you down pilot, that's, you know, pilots are pilots.
Mm-hmm.
Now you got to death. But see, he was a special pilot. He wasn't a pilot. He was a navigator engineer who knew a real lot of information. And that's why they wanted his butt out of there so bad. He was very, very involved in the development of a lot of things. And you know how they got him out? Running golf courses.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that's how, but you know,
mm-hmm.
he was an older guy. He was, you know, he had never been on the ground, you know, but
mm-hmm.
As a true story, they lost a lot. And that bird dog, man, it just feels good to talk to somebody, you know.
Mm-hmm. How often would you all be able to hang out with them in country?
Who?
The chopper pilots. I mean, were you able to spend time with them?
Yeah, some of them got attached to us for a little while, but that's what was wrong. When we were formed, 243 men, then we should have had a squadron, or I shouldn't say that, we should have had at least 2 to 4 slicks per platoon. And 2 guns per platoon.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
At a minimum. That's what we should have had. And they stayed, lived, breathed, eat, and they were dedicated. That gives you you know, wanted to be down for maintenance, whatever. Yeah, I mean, we needed that because we needed that chopper to be sitting there waiting. And if you got three teams out there, okay, and you got two choppers, nah. You got to have three teams out there and at least eight choppers or more.
Mm-hmm.
Because out of them six, two of them ain't going to work or might get shot down. So you need, you see, for what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
That's what they did wrong. And that was our first commander's on his outbound after action report was his biggest point.
Mm-hmm.
That we did not have the aviation assets that required us to complete our mission more successfully. We had to depend on, okay, I'm going down now, I'm working with 4th Infantry. Who they were, who's supporting them? The 155th Aviation, who they were, the 1st Aviation, where are they at? Who knows? You know?
Mm-hmm.
Their job, I'm not saying that they weren't good. I'm saying that in our job, we needed dedicated birds that would, no one had the authority to pull them.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had them pulled. And that's not the way it goes, you know. I mean, sometimes you're out there and you just can't get out, and they say, we've got to go back for fuel. And we'd have to dig in and just lay low for the night because you don't want to come out at night. You ain't getting out at night.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, try to, you know, shoot you and communicate and get out, you know. And that's where that fat came in, that fish wing. That little old slow-moving bird dog, boy, he'd be the one to find out and say, hey, there's an LZ, you know, 800 meters, 280 degrees, you know. Mm-hmm. Go, you know, because you don't know. You're on the run, man. You've been lost where you're at. And them damn maps are so old anyway,
mm-hmm.
you know. So... At times you hated it, you were scared, you wish you'd give anything for a 15-cent cheeseburger at that time, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But, if I had to do over again, I'd have done it again and again and again.
Why is that?
I just didn't think there was no reason to be in the Army and not be there.
Mm-hmm.
And I just got caught in a quagmire catch-22.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you can't extend. Why? You only have 150 days and 179 you can get out. I don't want out. Extend my ETS 90 days and I'm going to do another 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
They go up there. Oh, well, we can't extend it. Why? Well, you have orders to Fort Bragg. Well, how can I have orders to Fort Bragg when I can get out in 179 days? And I'm going to go home on 30, 40 day leave. When I get there, I'm going to have 100 days, 120, and 90 days, you're 90 day lost. That is not good economics. You know,
mm-hmm.
I said, I don't want to go. I want an early out. They said, you can't get out. I said, you just said I could get out. That's why you weren't going to extend me in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that's the Army.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to stay in Vietnam. Guys are trying to stay out of Vietnam, you know, and I'm trying to stay in the Army, and guys are trying to get out of the Army, and I get sent to, you know, the home of the junkies. I mean, the jumping junkies.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus, my God, over 70% of them have been to Vietnam at least twice. They were insane, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were either totally lifers or just waiting to get the hell out.
Mm-hmm.
It was total insanity down there. I mean, and then, of course, you didn't want to go out and play in the woods. Now, maybe if you was an E6 or an E7 as an instructor in a professional unit, but, you know, the people I got stuck with, I mean, I had a guy in charge of me that he ain't been nowhere, done nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and depending on his personality and my personality, you know, we might get along great or we're going to clash bad.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm getting at? So
yes.
It was hard to return. Some guys came back, returned, and then went back again.
Mm-hmm.
They just took whatever was coming to them.
Joey,
let me
ask you this. You guys were so tight-knit. What did you do with someone who really was kind of a bad egg in the group, who really didn't have
Well, you'd get peered out.
Peered out.
Okay, yeah. You come in, you go through interviews, then you go through a mini school, you know, see what, you know, what you're made of, week or two. Well, they made it longer afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And then, by that time, if they think you got your head on right, you go out on a mission, go out on another mission, and if you're doing okay, then they'll keep you. And then, like me, I had already been over there doing some similar missions.
Mm-hmm.
So I adapted a lot easier. I mean, I just went home for 30 days, came back, went to another unit, okay, and then went out on two or three missions, and they sent me to Recondo school.
Mm-hmm.
Once you go to the school, the big R school, the best school in the world, the best school I've ever been to, and just about anybody that's been in the Army will tell you that, SF and Ranger.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, once you complete that school, then you are physically, mentally ready. And you have to be in country 6 months to go to that school and be with LERPs or Rangers, you know. And the South Vietnamese could not go. They couldn't make it. It was only Americans, Australians, Thais, and Koreans.
Mm-hmm.
And Project Delta are the ones who were the instructors.
Okay.
As them guys got burnt out, like my buddy, the guy was in there, I think, 38 months,
mm-hmm.
they took him offline and he became an instructor.
Mm-hmm.
So you was being taught by the best of the best.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you either passed the test or you packed your bag. You know, it wasn't a bunch of yelling or nothing like that. It was like, okay, they opened the door, and they say, okay, you got a certain time to your full equipment, you know, and 30-pound ruck, whatever. You know, when we close the gate, if you're on the other side, you know, you're packing your bag and you're gone.
Right.
If you get less than 70% on any event, you're gone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're just gone. You ain't got time for it.
Mm-hmm.
I went with four guys, and one of the guys had been in country 7 months, good shape and all. He had a heart murmur the third day, never heard from him again.
Mm-hmm.
And he had been humping the hills for 7 months, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Another guy academically failed. He left in the first week. And another guy, he was a little bit slow, but he was worth the effort where they recycled him. I was the only one that graduated in the 21 days out of the four. And then Mac, he graduated on the next class. So he was recycled because he was, you know, worth salvaging. But one, he was a good friend of mine. He went on a run. He never came back.
Huh.
Third day. Well, they start you off at 1 mile. Then you go 2, 3, 4, 5, 7. Okay,
mm-hmm.
And you're running, this is, you know, you got full ammunition, everything, and you're, as it gets longer, your time gets shorter, it seems, and then, when they close the doors, when you're done, then you do your calisthenics.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way Special Ops does it. A good warm-up and a run or a ruck, and then they get you in the pit, and you go into a muscle failure. And then you go eat, and then you go to, you know, classes or training or whatever.
So by the time you guys got them in the field, they were ready to go. They had been through all this stuff.
No, you go to the unit first. That's like you don't go to Ranger school before you go to battalion. You come in, you go through basic training, infantry, jump school. Then the Rangers pick you up, and they put you 30 days of Ranger indoctrination program. If you complete that, then you go to a Ranger battalion and you stay with a Ranger battalion 6 to 8 months before they'll send you to Ranger school.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you go to Ranger school and you still go on all the missions and everything, when you go to Ranger school,
mm-hmm.
you know, you excel because you're ready.
Mm-hmm.
Or else they don't send you. You know, there's no such thing as, you know, now there was at one time, they did for SF and they stopped it real quick.
Mm-hmm.
But when you enlist for infantry airborne Rangers, that's just what you do. You'll do infantry airborne Rangers, and if you make it in the Rangers 6 or 8 months later, and that's even if you went to combat or training or anything, when you earn the right to go there and they feel that you know everything and you're going to be one of the best, then when you come back, usually, like my nephew, he was there 8 months. When he come back, he not only graduated, when he came back, he made Sergeant E5. Because
mm-hmm.
he had been there 8 months.
Mm-hmm.
Then he went to school. And that's what the Black Beret is about. See, Ranger school is only 8 weeks of hell. A battalion can be 3, 4, 5 years of hell.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That beret goes on your head a hell of a long time before that tab ever does. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a symbol of excellence. You know, and that's, I don't want to go into that. We'll waste time on that.
Okay.
But, yeah, we did. Our morale got low when things went wrong.
Right.
And, you know, of course we blame it on our officers and all that, but it really, most of them, they were having just a hardest time as we were trying to keep the support. And that was one of our weaknesses, the only weakness that I was really concerned about.
Mm-hmm.
Would that chopper be there?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
In all times, it was?
Oh, no. No. That's why I was worried, you know? I mean, it's nice when you call up and you say, I'm in contact, and said, the birds are rolling.
Mm-hmm.
Man, you know, I just got to hide, you know, hide, run, fight for maybe 10, 15 minutes. But when you hear, well, they're going back to refuel, well, where the hell they been?
Yeah. Exactly. I haven't seen
what?
Them.
You don't have a medevac? No, we don't have a medevac. He's out on another mission, see? Now I got to take you out in a ladder or a rope, a McGuire rig?
Mm-hmm.
That's where... you know, when you have special operations, that's why special operations was formed.
Mm-hmm.
The entire special operations command was formed because of Grenada or Grenade. When they went in there, the services could not communicate. Therefore, a lot of things happened that shouldn't have and that people don't know about.
Mm-hmm.
So now, United States Special Operations Command in MacDill is where everyone who's in special ops, whether it's Army, Navy, Air Force, or Marines, they leave their branch and they go there. And they are not told by their branch what to do. It's like when I went to drill sergeant duty, my records left the infantry branch and they went to the drill sergeant branch.
Mm-hmm.
And the infantry branch don't say nothing until it's time for me to go. When you go to SF, your stuff goes to SF.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
When you go to special ops, the Army doesn't tell you nothing because you fall under a joint command.
Mm-hmm.
The generals, like a 3-star Army general, then they have a naval XO, and then the sergeant majors, like an Air Force, and the first sergeant, like an Army, it's all joint service.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that's what makes them tick. They work together and train together, and it's competitive.
Mm-hmm.
You're damn right, it's competitive, but it's good. It's good, hard, good training. And we've also finally, you know, swallowed our egos and learned from each other.
Mm-hmm.
Learning from each other means we can support each other. Supporting each other means we have multiple power. Multiple power, we can multiply that force so much that it's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really cool, you know, like it's really cool to go through boat training where they think it's really cool to jump out of a plane. So it's really cool. they finally done it, and that's the way it should be.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't done in Vietnam that way, you know, but I'm saying the way it's done now. And I believe it's a three-star position that runs SOCOM, future SOCOM. That's in McGill, by the way, on the McGill Air Force Base in Tampa.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, it's right next to the golf course.
Right.
No, well, SOC Center there too, the Special Operations Central Command, that, you know, that takes care of the, that did the Gulf War,
mm-hmm.
the Special Ops.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But yeah, it's, and that's why I enjoyed it so much this time, because I got around to seeing so many different guys and things and countries, you know, and just, you just got to know a lot of people, and you had a joint camaraderie.
Mm-hmm.
You'd have your little competitions, but, you know, when you put us against another force, God help me. Yeah, I mean, seriously, because, you know, God better have your soul, because your ass is ours, you know, you know, no matter what we got to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, but we did, we were young and dumb and full of cum, so, you know, everybody that was given a ship was a lifer, and everybody that wasn't online was a rent. But it takes, including all the way back to the States, I think 11 people to put one man on the ground. You learn that as you get older and wiser, you know,
mm-hmm.
that without that truck driver, without that darn cook, without that supply man, you wouldn't have nothing. You wouldn't move
mm-hmm.
without the chopper, you know. And that's what I stressed when I came back into the junior NCOs. Don't talk shit. When I used to set up my class, I would intermingle them. I'd have an engineer, an infantryman, transportation, and personnel. Because all of you, because you got to touch on everything in that school,
mm-hmm.
all of you are going to help each other. When it comes to land nav, you'll help. When it comes to communication, you'll help. When it comes to effectively communicating, like counseling, this guy will help, and then you will become buddies. And 6, 8, 10 years from now, when you're first sergeant or whatever, when you need something, he's there for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's where you have to get along in the Army, but you don't realize that when you're young.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I think it's probably better that you don't realize any of that. And you don't realize the political. We didn't have the mass media that I had to deal with in 81. As a drill sergeant, these kids thought they knew everything, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they got to talk. You know, when I went to basic training, you didn't say nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You just hoped that you survived, and you just went and did what you had to do. There was no question about it at all, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That is our weakness. Putting black berets makes no one a better soldier. I mean, when I was in the Philippines, I wore a little BDU cap and name tag in U.S. Army. I wanted to look more like the Air Force than the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
You see, I didn't want to be known. That black beret did nothing but embarrass a lot of people who wear it, and ruined the general's career for making an illegal contract out of the United States and not in a time of emergency. They turned back $650,000 for bad workmanship. If, you know, the guy, I told you what happened when he showed up to Mark Anderson's at the funeral at Fifth Group, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, his father came out to his staff car and he said, "You are not welcome at my son's funeral."
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Anderson is a pretty big dude, you know.
Mm-hmm.
This guy's a 3-star general, and he just turned around and got back in there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And when he went around the corner, you know, it was a big hood, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, Mr. Anderson, when I'm calling him Mr. Anderson, was, you know, I respected the fact that he knew, and his son was a Green Beret, but had been with Rangers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to him, there was Green Berets out there, and there were Black Berets out there, and he knew that they were the same. You know, they worked together.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, the guy, and the sergeant of the army too. He'd been nowhere, done nothing. See, they were both tankers, and in the old days, the army used to wear black berets simply because they could look in the telescope better, whatever you call it, and their hands are always dirty. Mm-hmm. So they wore black berets. They never wore them in their class A's or nothing like that. It was like a work hat, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so they wanted to... Every general wants to leave something. Well, he left it. And then the guy walks 1,200 miles, and then he won't even sit down and talk to him.
Mm-hmm.
1,200 miles carrying a beret in his hand.
Mm-hmm.
That a friend of his has died before. Man, get out of here. And that some major lieutenant colonel sat down with him. Boy, he told him that he slammed that thing down, and he said, I'll tell you what, that man... It is something, the fact that I hope he doesn't wander into the wrong AO. And he said, are you threatening the general? And he leaned across, and he leaned across the table, and he said, sir, Rangers don't fucking threaten. They fucking promise. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. You know? He was insinuating that, and it's true that I know that if somebody had the opportunity, they would, they might not kill them, but they damn sure would make them suffer. They had the opportunity because what was he thinking?
Mm-hmm.
What was he thinking? To put a bunch of, the whole army and take away a tradition that's been going on for 35, 40 years, 50 years. You know, he had his head up his ass. And, you know, I have no respect for the man. I'd spit on his grave and his mother's grave. He was nothing. And the sergeant major of the army was lower than the lowest private to even contemplate something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So they did that in the 82nd Airborne in the 70s. Tackleberry, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be no more Maroon Beret. Within 48 hours, everybody just said, okay, well, we quit. We don't want to jump no more.
So
see, you can quit any time. This is volunteer. They can't make you jump out of an airplane. They can't make you go to alerts. They can't make you go to SF or Rangers. You're a volunteer. You can quit. So after about 60% of the division said, we're going to quit, he gave them back the beret.
Mm-hmm.
That's just what they did. And you know, well, the senior NCO sort of told them how to do it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Said, you want the beret? Quit. So I'm saying, I ain't going to jump no more. Without the 82nd Airborne, they're done. So everybody went up and turned in 4187, request to terminate jump status. You don't have to give a reply why. It is a law. That was it?
Yeah. So it made you mad more than it hurt your morale.
Oh. You know, what was he thinking? Oh, they interviewed him behind his back porch and all this kind of stuff and in his backyard and laying down his stuff. You know, he just was trying to prove a point about something. And I got to cut it short. I got to quit for the day.
Okay.
But, that, I mean, you know, we didn't wear, I mean, when we had... our jungle fatigue drawing. It was used because we'd come out of the field, we'd been dirty for so long and all, and they had everything sewed on, they were starched, you know, and it looked real nice, and we went downtown and we partied.
Mm-hmm.
But when we went on a mission, it was either the tigers sterile or the jungle sterile. But we could walk around like that anytime,
mm-hmm.
you know, and people know, you know, they just know that you're something.
Mm-hmm.
I had a guy, some major told me, tuck your pants in. I said, who are you talking to? He said, what? I said, you don't know who you are, who I am. And I said, look. And I opened, I had about eight big oozing leech holes. I said, see that? And he almost threw up. I said, I got a profile. I don't have to blouse my boots, okay? And you don't know who you're talking to. And I walked away. He didn't know who I was. I was an E4. You know, but that's the way we were.
Mm-hmm.
Fuck you. I mean, who the fuck are you who've been sleeping in an air-conditioned fucking barracks and wearing a new clean uniform every day questioning me? Okay? And that's the way we were. But I had a reason.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But the way he approached me, and it was around the PX, a lot of people around, and a couple of guys, said, hey, soldier, you need to buy some boots. I said, who are you talking to? I'm talking to you. Who do you think you're talking to? I said, I'll tell you, show you who I'm talking to. Look, you see that? And that big hole, that sparse for about 4 years from them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And we were just on a run. I couldn't get them off, and we were on a run, and I got ripped up pretty bad. But that's just the way it was. I mean, just stay out of my space. And inside our company, I never had no problem with the company commander, the first sergeant, the platoon sergeant, nobody.
Mm-hmm.
You did your job. You did it hard. You did your best. And that's it.
Mm-hmm.
There was no harassment. You know?
Yeah. All right, okay. You want to wrap it up for today, John?
Yeah, I need to.